Dealing with. It's a flagging issue that affects a number of areas.
Well, Madam Chair,
so what I in that conversation will encamp the issue of principles. We also did indicate to this honorable committee that in terms of the whole framework, we do give flexibility around the issue of targets, where individual sectors, in terms of the sector, formation process, are able to develop their own targets. But what we said is that in terms of principles, we must ensure that we have that seamless, harmonized process where if you're talking about ownership, how do you measure effective ownership? And we say that two components make economic interest and voting rights. So in all respects, whether you're dealing with money, liquid, generic, or hard, if you are measuring what is ownership, you have to use those two components. So really our intention is to strive for that constant approach. And we're saying that because we have actually evolved and moved from narrow base, which was the first wave of PE, and now we're in the broad base scorecard, which is the second element, we want to make sure that the market, the public service, everybody complies and aligns to the generic scorecard in terms of the second element. So a situation where you find that certain sectors only focus on ownership and management vis-a-vis the whole generic scorecard also creates inconsistency in application and unfairness where people are presenting that we need credentials. So the gist of this proposed funding is to then deal with those, mitigate those loopholes and make sure that whichever sector you are operating, if you are presenting your credentials, you will be measured on the same elements, seven elements, and the standard is the same so that you can come to the same result. So that is the crux of the issue. And we also highlighted in the document, Honourable Chair, that we have articles of education where the public policy has been used. We make examples like the Labour Relations Act, which is Section 2L, the Employment Equity Act, the Marine Living Resources Act, the Electoral Act, Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Anti-Discrimination Act, the Financial Intelligence Center Act, and the Municipal Distance Power and Practice Act. So really, this is also trying to demonstrate that this provision is a well-intense provision that you would find in other pieces of legislation, and we would also like to follow in terms of there is time to harmonize and make sure that there is a consistent approach. And we're saying that, oh yes, in terms of this coming provision in this statute, they are limited to legislation already in force at the time of the provision's enactment, as was the case cited in paragraph 1. So here we're saying that the explanation that is actually gave to say that coming provision will only apply to provisions that already exist since coming into effect of this amendment act. So in the future, we still emphasize on the members that if Parliament is appropriate to enact another legislation that actually at the time would warrant a different approach to dealing with PE, or just that legislation will take precedence over the current amendment act. So that is also a principle that is important. And again, we're saying that again, the rationale is to ensure greater diversion and community in the existing framework, because over the past 10 years since the enactment of the PE legislation in 2003, clearly the environment at the time was different when we first started this legislation. So since then, there's been a process of evolution in terms of how the PE has evolved. As in 2002, we didn't have a proper standard framework where you had also good practice. You only had the concept of narrow base, which was management and ownership. But since then, we moved on to say we need to create a proper framework. Hence, we mentioned that we must move the legislation today to offer that process. And then the other issue that we come from, which is bringing the Honourable Chair to the issue of the funding provision, is Section 10, because you can't apply the funding provision without looking at the provision of Section 10. So in Section 10, Section 10 of the Principal Act. As we indicated that those two must be venue together to make sure that there is no discussion in terms of the provision of Section 10.1 in where it refers to every organ of state taking into account and applying the rules of protection of standards in terms of the nomination of the proposed timing. And what we're saying is that it's important that again we create a situation where public entities and public organs of state do take into account and must apply this code of practice now that we have a clearly defined framework. Because we also acknowledge that in 2002 we did not have a framework. So you find that different organizations, different departments would set their own criteria in terms of how they would actually satisfy the issue of transformation. But now we have this generic scorecard, which was also a combination of a long and robust process within government itself to try to redefine how they would move forward with the issue of transformation. So in that regard, we're saying that there was broad consensus on the generic scorecard and the seven elements, and now we must make sure that there is that consistent approach across all public institutions so that we don't still have one organization focus on another thing and then the rest of the organization taking into account the federal focus in its entirety. And then another option that we wanted to convert and put forward to the honorable committee here is the fact that if all else is looking at the issues in terms of the uncertainty and you know the ramifications that might be expressed by our learned colleagues from state government around the effect and the intent of the public provisions to say, for us, the ultimate goal is to ensure that consistency in alignment. So that at the end of the day, we give the market a framework which is conducive and easy to apply. And saying that if the committee delivers and answers the pros and cons, then as a department, we're also willing to say, rather, if then we don't, you seem to be interested in terms of this approach of funding, we can put the funding provision, but put a caveat where we're saying that if you only take effect a year from the formalization of this act, so that we do allow, again, government and other states to start to align properly to this broader principle. And then post that 1 year dispensation, then if there is one project or legislation on the chair that is not aligned, then obviously the country committee in its current subject format must take in effect and come as particular policy. So this is another way that we think we can put forth to the committee to consider. And as we go further, we've highlighted the pieces of legislation, we highlighted the potential showing where we're saying that in terms of its key objectives, obviously there is a misalignment in there, but in 2011 we did the draft process regulation, which is the one that legislation to try and align to the new forecast. So now at least within the 80-20-90-10 principle of procurement, you have those designated points considered for BEE, and now the concept of the BEE forecast or the BEE level center at least does find expression within. But obviously that was just an internal arrangement, the broader aspect within the whole procurement framework that still needs to be tackled and addressed and talked to broader principles around BEE. So there are still areas of misalignment that are not quite done. Hence, there's a process between the DTI, National Treasury, Economic Development, to try and overhaul the whole CDPFA so that it talks to this broader objectives that the current today we try to address, even beyond the issue of that people being in. So that's one example. So we've given the members various sections where we say this is probably a misaligned provision because there are indicators we only align the regulations, not the principal act, in terms of the appropriating. So we also noted that the effective stakeholders also is continuing to raise the issue of the misalignment between the PPPA and the PPPA, as the objectives that are supposed to be achieved within the PPPA are not being achieved when they're using the national procurement framework within the PPPA. So in that regard, hence again, we needed to make sure that how do we then create within the school of paper a process where we can try to align, try to create the provisions, but also make it obligatory so that the key objectives do find expression within that. And we're saying that one of the things that was highlighted that the whole regime around the narrow base, which is management and ownership, still actually finds expression even today. So we need to start deliberately ensuring that we move away from that narrow approach and entrench the broad base approach in terms of the generic forecast and all those elements. And then we further proceed to talk about licensing concessions and other organizations and how then the funding and section 10, if we remove the third price of the possible without price. We're saying that the EFT as it stands now, it may impact greater or to a lesser degree on other legislation which actually applies to issues of licensing and authorizations. But what we are also noting here and we want the committee to take into account is that as much as we want to create a section 10 or the things they have been submitted, they say that section 10 must be mandatory, but it does not, it will not yield the effect that the economy will come to a standstill. In the sense that, on the chair, where you have circumstances you cannot demonstrate the applicability of CBA. We have in the past cases just like that, where we would grant exemptions to those companies. Case in point, last week, all of the members indicated what would be the situation if you have one service provider that provides a commodity. That means then if they don't have CBA, you can't continue with the economic activity. And we're saying that you can, because in that regard, we've always said within the code of good practice, there's that flexibility that if you as a company cannot demonstrate commitment, then you are able to grant, if you give an exemption, you can either do an alternative program which could be supply and development. If we do import skills from overseas, we are saying that at the time that those companies come into the country to bring those skills, there must be a delivery to a skills transfer program. Whether it's for a 3-year period or a 5-year period. We've also indicated that we've granted our state organs where there's a specific rationale, the belief of the data data. So in that regard, any company that contacts either with the mayor or with ESCOM or PSOSA, whom we've given belief of the system already, they are deemed to be really compliant. So in that regard, we're trying to deal with the challenge where the company will say, I'm unable to comply, or I'm the only service provider that can provide the service to government, but however, I'm not really compliant. So we're saying that we do cater for those exceptional circumstances, because we also understand the broader objective in terms of the economy being able to function properly. So we want to put that to the committee and say that if there is no people flexibility within the code, and then the alternative program, which is called a cooperative alliance, but also the exemption that the minister is able to grant, also afford companies to be able, and this has been the practice over the past 5 years, that is indicated with this organ of state that is granted to the state has to. Obviously, the state has been monitored for a certain definite period, and we must see the milestones. In year one, what kind of skills will be transferred, year two, year three, and then we go to that. And then we touched quickly on the Marine and Naval Resources Act, which is the act that governs the fishing industry. It also touches on the issue of how the policy is enhanced, because if you read Section 85, it requires the minister and consider an application for system that to have particular regard to the need to permit new entrants, particularly those from the services of the public society. So as we did indicate that there are those pieces of legislation that will seek to promote the transformation, but it doesn't really come out clear in terms of what kind of transformation we're talking about, whether it's the development forecast, but it does say any endeavor about transformation or taking into account previous disadvantaged people or new entrants to the market. So this is also one example of that project, and we also highlighted the implication of the Oceania Group here. Of particular interest, Honorable Chair, when we wanted a situation and example to give to the committee to say, at what point was the Section 10 used as an escape clause? It was used particularly in this case in the High Court. So in the High Court, the Department of Justice has relied on Section 10 to say it was not business responsible for them to apply the code, hence they used that and the court accepted that. But when it went further on appeal, because the Oceania Group was satisfied, then it was decided on a different case where the court said that we should have been clear as the legislator of the doctor in terms of what we had intended when we were speaking about a relevant code of conduct, I mean a relevant code of practice in terms of application. So hence they said that they will not give the department the benefit of doubt as to what our intention was, but rather we should have been explicit in the code, in the act, as to what exactly we intended when we're talking about a business that a method entity that does business government, or what we're talking about, we're talking about economic activity. So those were the issues that we noted and started from that judgment. And we're saying that it, again, this is one case in point where clearly now we also have an opportunity to clarify, as per the court has indicated, that clarify the intention, clarify what you exactly want, so that the market can be able to apply the policy properly. And then we've gone further to highlight the mining charter, also where there is a disaster in terms of the forecast, which is different from the green forecast, and also the beneficiaries. But however, here, all of our members, I must indicate that there are preliminary discussions that are taking place between the DMR and DCI around issues of alignment. There's no usual line. This charter did come up for alignment review, and we're saying that probably now we need to be consistent in our efforts and approach to make sure that there is that proper alignment in terms of the principles around the mining charter and the code of good practice. And then we also highlight the employment equity beyond the employment equity in terms of its core objectives of the employment, but they also seek to address issues of interest in the employment environment. But within the forecast also we have the element of employment equity. And there, how we've aligned in terms of definition, reporting, and then setting principles and not necessarily beneficiaries, because the context of the employment equity vis-à-vis the DE legislation are two different. So then you wouldn't have a case of one having the other, because we will use the same information underlying the information supplied by employers through the framework to assess their ability to comply with the employment equity under the DE forecast. So we're saying that whatever you submit, Department of Labor, in terms of how you are processing, must be the same information that you have made under the employment equity element on the DE forecast, so that there is correlation, we're able to verify that what companies are submitting is a true reflection of their data. So I think all of the members, all of the chair, this is basically a summary of our analysis as DCI, and we have endeavored to give further options in terms of how we can travel around the issue of the funding. But we still feel that it's important that within this field of within the legislation, we're able to come up with provisions that are going to be practical to apply, but at the same time, the main target that the market has raised, the multinational companies have raised, is that create a seamless, cohesive approach in terms of policy application, and then we are ready to apply. So I think this is what the SDGI is wanting to submit and say that at a snapshot high level, these are some of the legislations and the impact that they're coming with.
Thank you,
thank you very much, Chief Director. I am assuming that the state law advisor is familiar with the scene as it's in fact endorsing the position you gave.
Excuse me, Chairperson, can I just repeat that statement?
Yes, as it's not, last week you were making this particular point yourself, and as I see from here, the DCI is saying the following formulation of clauses proposed by the SLA was supported by DCI, and it simply gives their reasons, if you like, for that support. But it essentially is the point you had made. So I don't know now if you're moving away from that. I take it you are maintaining that position.
Yes, I am, Chairperson. The department mentions that the current provisions will not in itself, the implication of the 88 is some paragraph 28 of the department's document. The implication of the ATA's decision is that the insertion of the trumping clause as proposed amendment to Section 10 will not on their own be sufficient to work, but will go a long way to achieve greater consistency in the application of the EE's licensing position, etc. Yes, that is so. In their China case, the judgment was based on the fact that there was no relevant code applicable, and therefore the Supreme Court of Appeals said the policy applies. If there were to be a code under the Broad-Based Economic Empowerment Act relevant to the fishing industry, and if the trumping clauses would be in place, the Broad-Based Maximum Empowerment Act would trump any policy made by the Minister in terms of the Environmental Act. So it seems to me. If I may give a view, if the committee were to adopt the trumping clause, I would also support the 1 year delay of the clause for the Department to put everything in place. So the committee might like to consider that, and I support that delay. May I add something?
You may.
In relation to Section 10.
Just a
The proposal.
Like all the time seems all right.
Thank you. Okay. It relates to the proposed amendment to section 10, which occurs on page 5, line 22 of the bill. The department proposes that the word as far as it reasonably possible be omitted. The committee may want to consider also the words which occur prior to those words, the word take into account and as far as. Because if you take out as far as reasonably possible, the word take into account doesn't rhyme or doesn't fit with the must apply part. So I suggest that the commissioner says you take out after omit the word. Take into account and as far as it is possible.
Yes, I think that was raised last time when the issue of reasonably possible was raised, that would be consequential in any case. So we would remove from public must take into account and. So if we remove the one, we remove both.
Quite a departure from the current provision in the Act. The committee might also have to consider perhaps to put a amendment on this provision also, because it's such a departure from the current.
We may have to do what?
In the case of the trumping provision, the department proposed that there may be a delay period of 1 year. And I don't know whether it should also perhaps apply to section 6.
All right. We've now got the state law advisors' advice and opinion on the matter. I hope everyone got that. Okay.
Madam Chair, I didn't quite get what Mr. Smuts raised as his second point, because we're discussing the trumping clause in this memorandum, and I think the DDG explained very well what the term is. But as we must raise the second matter relating to reasonable, what was the phrase again?
No, it's
part of the as far as reasonably possible. Now, that is in the existing Act, and it wasn't in the bill at all. There was no amendment. It came in 3 days ago as a proposal. And it came from the DTI. And the sense, as I understood, was that we felt there wasn't any need to remove that. That was my conclusion. So I'm not quite sure whether Advocate Smuts has been having some more discussion of a bit of arm wrestling with the DTI in the meantime.
Yeah. Uncle McIntosh, just to refresh your memory a little, you will recall that was discussed in committee, this issue of reasonably possible. We did discuss it. It was raised, you see. So, especially in line with they wanted to give everyone a loophole, or what is the intention? And we actually discussed that. What is the intention, and are we supporting the principal intention here? And does that in any way undermine it? And I think that is the issue, and I think the point is, at that meeting, we also pointed out, or we realized from what perhaps one of the advocates had said, that the trumping clause, if we left, is reasonably possible. The trumping clause would contradict this. I mean, you know, some of you here have got legal, backgrounds and so on. So that was one of the issues, if I recall, that the trumping being requested by the subcommittee would have contradicted the impossible, do you see? So we did discuss this, but we thought we'd wait until we got the trusting position, you know, the position on that. Honourable Kadiri.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think what is important here, really, I think the department has gone out of its own way to try to put a basis for the funding cost. And then with this imposition made here, Chair, I think that this is the reason for the committee to allow the funding cost to be put into the bill. I think that's the critical aspect. And the issue of the delay of 1 year is also very reasonable, Chairperson, because as I said, that the other entities have to comply with that. The other departments have to comply with that. So it means that if you don't put that 1 year delay, it means that this act will be exerting unreasonable pressure to the other entities, of which they are not part. They are not part of this conversation we are holding now. So I think, Chairperson, they have laid a very good background why the capital must stay in. I think that even as the majority of the people who are here in the public hearing also supported the traffic law. But I think with this thing, with the way it's formulated and the way it's captured, I think that's going to cover everyone, the person, even those who never had a reservation for us. So as to the issue as far as reasonable cost, I think that we also requested, I can see that there was only one paragraph dealing with that. Can they still go to plan, repeat that, go to plan on that thing? Because the issue which we raised with the issue of the forest is the, yeah, exactly, strategic industry, which is unique next. The monopoly that you cannot avoid without one. So can they please repeat that again,
yeah,
so that they can
right.
Plan,
you hear what is being said at the time as well, we would be discussing this point was also made, what do we do with those strategic industries which may come from outside, externally to the country, which may not comply, as it were, to the letter of the law. How would this impact? I think that was one of the issues as well. Wonder, and maybe we can ask yourself, is it advocates what? Advocates what? You were here then, so you remember all of that. Thanks.
Thank you. I think maybe a switch of my views on the funding provisions first. I've looked at the funding provisions and I've looked at specifically our litigation where there is a direct conflict. The one being, which was also mentioned in the public hearing, was the Electronic Communications Act, which has stricter DE requirements than what the DE Act has. For instance, had 50% ownership stipulated in the Act. And I thought about this, I even discussed it with the department and what the proposal, or actually they tried to remedy this by the amendment in the current law, which is the amendment to Section 9, which is on page 5 of the law, Amendment 5C, which means subsection 9, subsection 6 of section 9, which reads that if requested to do so, the minister may by notice publicly submit all the state or public entities to specify qualification criteria for procurement and other economic activities to be validated by the minister. The assurance that I got was, for instance, in this instance where the restricted criteria, and if it now says that I'm going to apply the DEA Act standard, then the Electronic Communications, the minister responsible for this act can apply to the minister of PCI to have the qualification criteria to take more stricter ones, which would then satisfy what the Minister of Communications decided to do in this piece of legislation. So in that respect, I would be satisfied that if there is stricter criteria, then there is a solution in place where that minister can apply to the the Minister of PCI to access the criteria. On that thing, of the strategy. The other issue on the issue of whether there's a scarcity, whether only one service provider can provide the service. I have also discussed it with the DCI, and they assured me that in such an instance that they do give the license, but then they will seek qualifications and they will seek requirements for that service provider to come back in a year or 2 years' time, to come back and say what have they done in respect of the service. Not an instance where they cannot make use of the service. They will just bring this criteria for the person to comply with and come back to the department to that respect.
Members, I'm looking at you. Those who raised that issue, are you satisfied or want to comment, raise questions? Honourable Elvis, Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In our previous discussions on this issue, Honourable Khadebe raised the relevant issue around skills, and I raised the matter around a case of emergency.
Yes.
So, the practical aspect of this would be that if there's you need emergency procurement for whatever reason, let's say there was an earthquake and there's no black company available to do assist for the help of it with specialized assistance in getting people out of the rubble, for instance.
Yeah.
Let's say only a company that's
yeah.
white, majority white, then this will disallow procurement of their services in an emergency situation, which is crazy. We either need to keep in as far as reasonably possible, or we need to create exceptions to the rule and define them properly. Thank you.
Of course, you've given us an extreme, you know, as it were, position, and perhaps that is the way to look at it from that extreme position. Let us take Honourable McIntosh as well, which may be on the same point.
Madam Chair, now I think you're right. It is an extreme position. But that's exactly what, as far as reasonably possible, is to deal with. as the DDG said, we don't want to cripple or handicap government. And this clause is only an organ of state and public entity must take into account, and as far as it's reasonably possible. Now, that would apply to any organ of state and a public entity throughout the Republic of South Africa. Now, I don't believe that those organs are not going to want to basically follow the government policy, nor do they want an embarrassing situation. But at least if they are in a jam, as it were, and they feel they've got to do certain elements, then they can make a case, but they'll have to make a case that it's reasonably possible. And that to me is quite a significant element. And also, I mean, I take the point that you argued very effectively in this memo and presented just now, but I still think, certainly if I was in the situation of providing important facilities, I think it would be better to have it in.
Right, you raised the issue of it only deals with forms of state and public entities. All right, Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I think after the Chief Director raised a certain issue which for the President in a court of law. That's why I wanted to repeat that up so that we can look whether if we did that, can we be explicit that in the regulations which are going to accompany this act. This act going to be implemented, that this issue of skills and emergency situation will be explicitly tackled there next. Because I think we should not go through again with that court precedent so that we are convinced.
I think the point is really that we don't want to adopt a position that becomes law, that then find that actually we're unable, in not just emergency situations, but in a number of very serious situations, to access the requisite skills. Because I think that is not the intention here, per se. The intention is to broaden that, you know, economic empowerment. So, we are hearing some reservations. Can you hear that? As to the skills, for example, as to external companies, foreign companies coming in on a very specific thing, because at this stage we don't have all of these specialized services. That is another reality. So I'm just looking at the DTI. I'm looking at the state law advisor, parliamentary law advisor, and just checking whether or not you believe that this will satisfy the query. And the question's been raised, the concern. They are very real ones at the moment. What is the current environment? So I don't want, I'd like you to look at it seriously. If you think you can't do justice to it, you need to say so at this moment. Thank you. New Chief Director.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Member, I think our indicator, the escalator watch has indicated that currently now, the data court, you have a situation that there are certain commodities or services that you cannot get here within our country, some of our borders. Case in point, for instance, I'm in the defense industry. Some of the expertise and commodities and services that are required, they have to import from overseas. On the one hand, it's important to get those skills and bring them in the country. On the other hand, we offer the national objectives of making sure that we broaden participation, we comply with the digital scorecard. So what happens in those situations that we indicated that we've got various facilities within the regulatory framework of the code that the minister can exercise. One example I indicated that where you have a organ of state in a specific industry, let's say defense, American South of the Nile, they have applied to the DTI because they know in terms of the airplane what we need to do. So they'll apply to the DTI to say, can you grant us what we call a free facilitator status? That statement effectively says, anyone that contracts with you, if you procure services from that particular supplier, you are deemed automatically to be compliant. Therefore, whether you're the multinational company from overseas bringing in skills, we need your services because we don't have that internally. If you contract with the NAD, you will be deemed automatically to be compliant. So there we cater for those situations that another member has raised to say, what if you need critical skills to come and to bring those into the country? So we cater for that. So even if it's on an LFL basis, we are able to go from department to department, we engage, they engage with the ICC, we have this statistic reason that there is this issue that is happening, be it a nuclear plant or the book or whatever, but we need to make sure that the company that is being overseas is not prejudiced and then they also get the recognition. Then we grant them that data on an agent basis, we've done it in the past. And then we've got on further to say that because we've got different elements within the scorecard, yes, maybe a multinational company or a company even locally can say, I'm not able to dispose of direct equity, which is ownership. That's the beauty of the scorecard, because we've got issues of supply development, skills development. So even in that situation, we say that if you come in, let's say, as an outside company, you're going to be contracted by government, we say that if your contract is 3 or 5 years, within that, you must put a plan in place to say that as I render the service to the government, I will also transfer these particular skills. Or if it's a question of expanding on our R&D, then I will bring R&D within the country and make sure that you set up the centers of excellence where you start now to develop your own intellectual capability around maybe that particular product. So as I indicated also, we've done those kind of concessions and granted those kind of authorizations in the past, where we say in lieu of that, then you can do a supply development where you either you take 5 companies and then you make sure that in the next 7 years you will develop those companies to have the same expertise as you in the market. So there are those honorable members,
those alternatives and trends to within. And another thing with control is that for you to enter the dose control, you don't have to just demonstrate your compliance. There are other criteria, as standard and as standard, then to be compliant issues as indicated. All this is within the 10 to 20 to have the 10 requirements after issues of price, functionality, and other aspects. So it's not the entry. It's not for you to demonstrate your become before you enter the door. There are criteria that are discussed by government that they need to test before they get to the pre-compliance aspect. So we're saying that also remember that there will be a question that if you need a contract because the company is not being compliant, therefore then you cannot contract. Business will continue as usual. The economic activity will continue as usual. But also saying beyond those exceptional cases, we're saying that still R&D, supply development, those who factor in lieu of saying that the company is clearly to transfer those who don't recognize what we are as a country.
Thank you. Arnold McIntosh, just last point coming up from yourself, followed by Advocate Elders.
Madam Chair, I take the point, but I do have a slight sense of deja vu. About 30, 40 years ago, developed a big shipbuilding industry in Durban, but we had to bring in Doorbell or James Hammer Brown from Glasgow to come and give us the advice. And in due course, it became a South African business, but we wouldn't have needed to, for example, go to the Agulhas and have it built in Finland, probably, if we still had our shipbuilding industry, we may get it in South Ghana with the SEZ. But the other thing which is interesting about what we've just heard about reclassifying, you know, in South Africa, we had the Japanese capital coming in the 60s, and it was a great embarrassment because they weren't white. So Dr. Goodwood made Japanese honorably white. So now we're going to have honorably black because of economic necessity. But that's the reality, Madam Chair. I'm pleased the DDG understands that one may have to abandon the race element to actually keep growth and economic development going, because it's a very powerful engine for development and growth.
Okay. We'll complete it on that note with yourself, Honourable McIntosh, and just come back to Honourable Albert.
Madam Chair, thank you. My issue wasn't with the customs, but regarding diversity situation. So if we have a very strict application where there's no deviation from the VE code, especially with regard to preferential procurement policy, I know that the EPFA Act sets out the rules, the 80 or 90 to 10 rule, 80 to 20 or 90 to 10 rule, but it is stated here in the memorandum that clause 16 on page 4, that the Preferential Procurement Act depends to be aligned to this act. And what that means is that act, the Procurement Act, will change. Now the question is, how will it change? Will it follow the rules, status, and principles stated in the Black Economic Empowerment Act?
What page are you on?
In the memorandum, on page 4.
Oh, the memorandum,
yes.
Right.
If you read clause 16, read based on concerns raised, certain aspects of the DE Act and the PPPFA Act may need to be further aligned. The DTI, NT, and EDD are already engaging in regard to overall the PPPFA inside. So, the PPPFA, while at the moment it is 10 or 20 points of percentage to the economic empowerment, that might change, it might be increased. And if there is, in terms of clause 10, of the VE ball, not allowed to be any deviation in implementing the code of good practice. It can still mean, and it might even mean more, that even the minister cannot create exceptions to allow foreign skills and allow procurement in emergency situations. So it actually furthers the possibility of deviation even more. So I don't understand where DTI says that the minister can allow for exceptions. He cannot break the law. He can only do what the law allows him to do. Thank you.
Now, we are going to do on this note because it is getting quite thorny legally on the matter, and I can see the advocates wanting to just consult with each other. Now, we've done a fair amount on the topic, all right, and we've agreed on one or two areas. There are some outstanding. Let us just leave that for a moment. I hope everyone's listening. Come back to it because there are certainly some thorny points here because I think the Act does certainly apply to government, public sector, and perhaps stable. It applies to any company per se in the country, private company, cannot say, or public. And we may want to just look at that briefly. So we are coming back to this, and I want that clear. And what I'd like to do now, members, we've got another flag, which we'll come back to. Remember the one on the black, should we see this one or that, the one that you raised on, or James, but also on, or Macintosh. And I'd like us to go to the page of the actual amendment bill itself, where we were, and that was by the looks of things, on page 8 at the bottom. I'm just making sure on my own notes. No, the first here. And I'm going to just check here. Right. That's where we were. Now, I want to get through this in case there are other flags. Can we do that? Right. So we're not abandoning the trunk mechanism. We're coming back to it. Now, members, on page 8 there, and also looking at the amendments that have been proposed coming from the subcommittee as well, but we're going clause by clause, you will recall. Okay? So, on the members, the subcommittee, that was page 4 by the look of things. Page 4 of this. Mine is saying page 4 for some reason. Yes, this page, we've done before here in Spectrum and 3G. We're up to here. On page 8, from line 28, you get that there?
Yeah.
Right. To omit subsection 2 and to substitute all public companies. And you will recall, we dealt with that. It was the last issue we dealt with. It's over. It was resolved by Honourable Hill Lewis, the general clarification for all of us. So we now move beyond that to the amendment proposed at point 8 here on page 8, line 36. Right. And line 36, to omit an assignment. We had also just taken that position, and the reason we understood very clearly there were no flags. However, it did mean that on page 8, line 44, we had to omit the word assignment or assignments again. All right. Now, on page 9, now we do need to go here and to omit 13E in brackets 2. 13H, do we agree? We have someone proposed. We move on. Thanks, Honourable Jay. Seconded by Honourable Hadeg. Right. Specialist committees. 13I. And 1 and 2 on page 8. Going through to 9A. B, C, D, sorry, A, and then we come B again, to consist 4AB, to consist of small Roman I, small Roman 2, and then 5. A member of a specialist committee must A, B, C. 6. Members of a specialist committee must not A, B, C. 7. A member of the specialist committee ceases to be a member if A, B, C. 8. A member of the specialist committee who has any particular personal or financial interest in any matter on which the committee gives advice must disclose that interest and withdraw from the proceedings of the specialist committee when that matter is discussed. 9. The commission must remunerate and compensate A, B. 3rd, with respect to 13I129, we have someone to propose that we adopt. That's Honourable Khadiri, seconded by Honourable James. We now move to investigations by the Commission. 13J. 1. Subject to the provisions of this Act, the Commission has the power. As the power on its own initiative or on receipt of a complaint in the prescribed form to investigate any matter arising from the application of the Act, including any BBBE initiative or category of BBB initiative. Now, we come to the subcommittee. It refers us here on your point 11. On page 9, line 61, do you see that? To admit the commission may refer to and to substitute. Line 61. And that takes us through to page 10, so we'll just move briefly across to 10. The Commission may, if it has investigated the matter and justifiable reasons exist, refer to. That is the right. I see everyone nodding here. So we then move to page 10 after line 9, and that is of course the current subsection A. But we're going to stop just there and ask you 13J, investigations by Commission 13J, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, A, B, the amendments already included here on 9, 7. We have someone to propose the adoption thereof. I'm looking at members. Honourable James to the fore again. Oh, Honourable Mabasa. Thank you. Seconded. We then on page 10 after line 9. Okay. To add the following paragraph. The current subsection becoming paragraph A. And if they want us to add B, seven A is the commission may publish, seven B, a decision of the commission to publish any finding or recommendation it has made may not be put into effect. And then we have a series of amendments. Small Roman 1. Before proceedings for the judicial review of the decision have been completed or were not instituted within the period allowed therefore. Roman 2. If the Commission has referred the matter to the National Prosecuting Authority or the South African Police, in terms of, is it South African Police Services, the official name?
Yes.
Well, then we need to put that in, don't we? In terms of subsection 5, and no prosecution has been instituted against the person concerned. Number 3. If the person concerned has been prosecuted and acquitted following the investigation of the commission, or 4. Where the person concerned has been convicted by a court of law following an investigation of the commission, before such person has, in respect of the conviction, exhausted all recognized legal proceedings pertaining to appeal or review. Right, that was that amendment there coming out of the subcommittee, which applies there. Right. So I want to get that quite clear now, so that you know that the current after line 9, the following paragraph, the current subsection becoming paragraph A. This amendment is paragraph B. Right, so 7A is there, and now an addition of 7B. Do we have somebody to adopt that proposed amendment from the subcommittee? Honourable Khadebi, followed by Honourable Wahid. Thank you. Now, we go to page, well, we can't just go to page 11 just yet. 13K. 13K1. At the time during an investigation being conducted by the commission may issue a summons to any person who is believed to be able to furnish any information on the subject of the investigation or to have possession or control of any book, document, or other object that has a bearing on that subject. A. B. 2. A summons contemplated in subsection 1, A, B, 3. If a person is summoned to appear before the commission or is required to deliver any book, document, or other object to the commission, the commissioner or an employee of the commission designated by the commissioner, A, may retain, B, may retain. 4. A person questioned by the commission must answer each question truthfully and to the best of that person's ability, but A, not obliged. B, a person asking the question must inform that person of the right set of the right or rights. Is it right or right? Set up. Just looking at everyone who's now absolutely fine. Set out in paragraph A, B, apart. No self-incriminating answer given or statement made, etc., will be admissible. Now that takes us to 13K, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Do we have someone to propose adoption thereof? Honourable Kwabasa, seconded by Honourable McIntosh. 14 of the amendments, we still not there. 13L, confidential information. When submitting information to the commission, a person may claim that all or part of that information is confidential. 2. 3. 3A, B. 4. A person who has made a claim contemplated in subsection 1 in respect of which the Commission has made a decision in terms of subsection 3 may apply to the court for a review of that decision within A, 15 days. So we're still not in line 1. Alright. 15 days, we now come to some of the amendments here, which are noted in your point 13 on page 5. On page 11, in line 1, to omit 15.15 and to substitute 60. I have a note here that this came up there for a lot, much longer time, and the reason for it was Honourable Kadevi.
Under Pacha, the scheme was provided for S180 in 1840, but the Joanne said that it was going to be full of the only part reduced to 1640. Although I still kept quoting previously, but when I looked at my notes, it was quoting.
Official of an organ of state or public entity. becomes aware of the commission of, or any attempt to commit any offence referred to in subsection 1, and fails to report it to an appropriate law enforcement agency, is guilty of an offence. 3. Yes, Honourable McIntosh, that was under 2.
Yeah, that's a very radical presumption of somebody. I'm just thinking in general, getting it approved through particular, but I think the state law guides, I know there are some obligations on people like accountants and whistleblowers and people like that, but it just worries me in terms of human rights, that sort of assumption, and also places a burden on anybody if they, let's suppose it's hearsay, they're in a coffee shop and they overhear a discussion. Are they actually guilty of an offence? I mean, maybe Normanda can give us some advice there. But it just worries me. I just had a sense of concern about that kind of clause.
You know, I look here at subsection 1 that it refers to. You know, 13.1 on starting on page 11. It says here, the person knowingly commits this, provides false information. Then you go on to provide false information or misrepresents it or engages in fronting. The point you're raising is under 2. If you're a professional and you are aware that there's fronting going on, your job is surely to avoid that. If you are, again, the public in a procurement office or whatever, and you are aware of this offence, surely you have a duty. It's the equivalent of a police officer seeing you commit an offence when you say, well, you could be whistleblowing. I think you're not talking about a lay person. You're talking about someone who is verifying. That's their job, verification, or procurement officer. These are the people who pick up the fronting. Surely you've got to say to them, you have an obligation when you see this to report it. Do you not agree, Honourable McIntosh?
Well, I think you're right. It is a professional in that particular area. But it just worries me. I mean, I'm a professional driver, and if I drive with somebody who doesn't have their seatbelt on, and I don't report it or don't instruct them, do I commit an offence? It's an interesting issue.
No, you do. Can we then move on? Well, not move on. We were on to 3. Any person convicted of an offence in terms of this act is liable to A, B, 4. For the purpose of determining a fine to be imposed for an offence in terms of subsection 1, the court must take into account the value of the transaction which was derived from, or thought to be derived from, the commission of the offence. 5. A court in which any person is convicted of an offence in terms of subsection 3 must report the conviction A to the BBBE verification professional regulator, if that person is a BBBE verification professional. And B, in any other case, to the council and to that person's employer. 6. Despite anything to the contrary contained in any law, a magistrate's court has jurisdiction to impose any penalty provided for in this act. So you ought to take an account of that. Right, that was 13.0 A, B, C. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Can we have somebody to propose adoption of this clause? Thank you, Honourable Kadir. Be seconded by Honourable Vandenova. Right. Now we come to prohibition on business with organs of state.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to check if there's a clause in this document from the department on page 12 in line 36, after not to insert for a period of 10 years from the date of conviction. I don't know where my master copy bill has disappeared to in this massive paper we get thrown at us.
No, but haven't you got this big book? The very big one.
Yes, no, I've got it.
You can hand this out.
No, I've got it, but I've got my own bill, but somehow I've misplaced it in my old age.
Fine. Well, maybe you ought to bring the big one, alright? So, prohibition on business with organs of state following conviction under the Act. That was 35. Now we're coming to 36, in which you do have an amendment from the subcommittee. It says, on page 12, in line 36, after not any person convicted of an offence in terms of this Act may not, to insert for a period of 10 years from the date of conviction, may not, for a period of 10 years, contract or transact any business with any organ of state or public entity, and must for that purpose be entered into the register of tender defaulters. You can read that English word in two ways. Tender, very soft. Oh, of course, the technical term. You know, they will understand the technical term. And the tender defaulters, which the National Treasury may maintain for that purpose. Alright. English is a strange language, That appears to have been in the last of your amendments from the subcommittee. All right. Having put that in under 13P1, we then say 13P2. Now, can we have someone to propose adoption of 13P1 and 2? Thank you, Honourable James. Seconded by Honourable Hadebi. And moving on to substitution of section 14 of Act 53, 2003. The following section is hereby substituted for section 14 of the Principal Act. Regulations, guidelines, and practice notes. There were no actual amendments put forward. 14.1. The Minister may make regulations with regard to A, any matter that in terms of this Act may or must be prescribed. B, the lodging of complaints with the Commission. C, the conducting of investigations by the Commission. D, the information that any organ of state, public entity or private enterprise is required to provide the Commission and on the form and period of such reporting. This is the only place that I recall, that I'm saying recall, I'm sure someone in the committee will refresh my mind, that we have the reference to as private enterprise. I'm looking at the chief director as well. All along it would appear to have been, you know, the state, etc., and a public company. This is the first time the concept of private enterprise comes in. And it's referring to information that should have been provided in the regular course of business, as it were. ancillary or incidental administrative procedural matter that is necessary to prescribe for the proper implementation and administration of this Act. 2. The Minister may by notice in the Gazette issue guidelines and practice notes relating to the interpretation and application of this Act. So the only reason I raise that is because you refer to the private enterprise in D, and then in E, it talks about all transactions involving this. So that presupposes the whole of the economy, anyone involved in that. I hope I'm right. You know, whether it's a private enterprise, an individual, or whatever, involved in this. Right. Having said that, then, there were no amendments in this regard.
So Madam Chair, I think you raised a very interesting point. Maybe Normandia could just give us her insights, but she seemed to all of her life to a flickering.
Really? I must say I didn't see them, but we're going into these directors.
And thank you, Honourable Chairman. I think the reason we have said they have mentioned private sector, as you clearly articulated, Honourable Chair, is that we expect that all transactions above a certain threshold that will be determined by the Minister and announced to the public will be closed with the Commission. Because what has happened in the past is that we don't have a portal where we record these BE transactions. So you find that when we have to account to actually give an overview as to what is the state of transformation, what has been the impact of this transition. Government doesn't have that kind of portal so that we can indicate in this set time, this is the number of transactions, what has been the impact. So that's why most people who participate in these kind of transactions then would be private sector. So that information, we say that we should be able to have the power to say to them, this is the kind of information we need for you to register your being transaction with the Commission.
All right, now I think everyone's been satisfied with that explanation. So we'll go to 9 then, which is substitution of section 14 of Act 53, 2003. 9, the following subsection is hereby substituted to section 14 of the Principal Act. Regulations, Guidelines and Practice Notes 14.1 A, B, C, D, E. F 2. Then we have someone to propose. Thank you, Honourable Vandermeerde, seconded by Honourable Mabasa. Short title and commencement. This Act is called the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Amendment Act 2012. And comes into operation on a date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. So we haven't got a particular date, although I think the State Law Advisor and perhaps yourself, Chief Director, were talking about the delay of sorts, a year. Was that to do with the Act or the code? But that's all in the Act. So something's going to be in the Act. You know, it's in the bill itself. So I think we just need, we have said here on a date fixed by the President. But we do have to address that, Honourable Kadevi.
Honourable, when it comes to the laws in the entirety, only that section whereby the other departments and entities must comply with that, not the entire. The entire Act, the bill as a whole. So I think that's what must be only that section of the trumpet must go forward.
So that is the only one we are wanting to address at this point on that. Now, members, we're going back to one little flag which we haven't dealt with, and that's right at the beginning. We're going to come back, giving you a chance over tea break on the trumping. But on page 3, um, I'm really not going to allow too much space, Honourable McIntosh, not too much space here at all, because we really fresh this up. You will recall we're talking of page 3B, and you need to perhaps go forward and say, it's the definitions here, you're talking about triple B, verification professional regulator, the previous page, and then by the substitution for the definition of black people of the following definition. Black people means Africans, colored, and Indians, and I'm just looking at my clauses here, page 3, from line 3, to admit Africans, colored, and Indians. Do we see that there on your subcommittee as a substitute? Persons classified as African, colored, Indian, or Chinese under apartheid law. Honourable James, let's have your input there quickly.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'd like to define the problem and then provide a solution. I hope it's a solution that I'd like to share with the committee, and I'm going to have a piece of paper just to help. Case number number CPP 3410, I can give you the document. And in it, it provides reference to the meaning of exposure to disadvantaged individuals. So we have that here. Also, if you look at the National Credit Act, there is a definition of historical disadvantaged person, and the definition is given. And there are two other references in the Municipal Systems Act and so on. So there is a jurisprudence on what it means to be socially disadvantaged. So what I put together was the following, which I have before you. I can just go through it very quickly. Is to say that black people is a term of convenience. And it is a term of convenience because it includes people who are not black in color. But it's a term of convenience that's historically rooted here. And very importantly, it's a synonym for historically disadvantaged persons, where those persons can be very precisely defined as follows. Firstly, they're citizens of the Republic of Turkey of Russian descent, or they became citizens, and then we have one and two, which I have before you. And then thirdly, which is really the important thing, due to the public policy that had been in place, where people had no franchise, the national elections prior to the introduction of our constitution of 1983, which is a tricameral parliament that excluded black people, or the constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1993, which is the interim constitution was used as we went into our democratic era. And then secondly, including individuals with resistant case-qualified franchise that came to an end with the introduction of the Separate Representation of Voters Act. That act was deemed to be unconstitutional at the time and was replaced by the South African Amendment Act of 1956. My grandfather, by the way, had the right to vote under this in the case. So what that does is it makes no reference to race, see, all of this. It's a fine historically disadvantage. And I think it covers all the bases for what it is. So that is why I propose, colleagues, as a replacement to deal with that set of difficulties.
Yes,
because
the NCA is one of our own pieces of legislation, I've just looking at it to refresh my own mind briefly. However, I'm going to refer you to it. I don't have the pages on per se, but it does define that particular one. I didn't recall it defining it. And I think that it is going to, because we want to, I think, have the benefit of discussing these issues just among ourselves, maybe in within our own parties, if I can be quite precise. It calls for an adjournment, just, you know, tea break in any case, because it is not our practice simply to throw something out because it doesn't agree with X or Y, but to try and look at it very seriously. So I want to thank you for at least giving us something in writing, which makes it a lot more helpful. And then I have asked Margot to make the NCA available to us, and I'm sure she can have it there. But I want to propose a 10-minute tea break, please. Thank you. I'd also like a trusting issue to be put to that.
Some don't talk clearly at all. Some talk at lightning fast. And they talk a lot of things very quickly. The essence of what they're saying.
Honourable James, and I'm now looking at the HDI division definition in, regulation 1H, this one with Judge Mulhane's judgment, and there's a footnote 21 where it says what an HDI is. It's not quite the same as Honourable James, but it's similar. And then the thing that I'm concerned about is not just the history, because I believe that you believe constantly in history and that you're structurally stuck and that you can never rise above your circumstances, then you're in a no-hope situation in this country. And I personally strongly believe that black and the old literature of black are highly competent, highly capable, and can perfectly well get out of their circumstance. So we want to talk about the future. So at the bottom of that section you get, provided that the person, the last sentence on page 13 of this document that our secretary is so efficiently, I must say, we're such an efficient bunch of secretaries, who obtained South African citizenship on or after the coming into effect of the Income Code is deemed not to be an HDI. Now, Madam Chair, to me, we, in terms of the objectives of achieving what I would prefer to call corrective action, recoupment, and so on, and we have this definition in, then we've got, I believe, a very, very constructive, positive contribution to improving this bill and pulling out its racial elements.
Thank you very much, Honourable McIntosh. Right, I have said, Honourable James, that I'll let you go next, then Honourable Albert, followed by James.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The submission by Honourable James is a very good submission for various reasons, as alluded to by Honourable McIntosh. I'd just like to read to you the Constitution as well. Clause 9.2, Equality Clause in the Bill of Rights. You see, equality includes the full and equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms. They aim to promote the achievement of equality legislated and other measures designed to protect the vulnerable persons. Four categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination may be taken. So it's not about people that were disadvantaged, and not so much people of race, although that coincides with race in part. But, you know, we've come a long way since 1994, and we all know that various groups of people have been disadvantaged in the past. And I think the first point I'd like to make regarding this is that if you take out the reference to in this definition of Honourable James, the fact that there's no reference to race or reference to the word African, because I regard everybody who is born in South Africa or on an African continent as African, irrespective of their race. Not all Africans are necessarily black, by skin colour. Even if you go to the northern part of Africa, you find people of light in you. So this helps a lot to take away that differentiation. But it also talks to historically disadvantaged people. Not only, and this is acknowledged in the Employment Equity Act, not only are the disadvantaged people regarded as just black people, in a traditional sense, but also white women who were caught up in a patriarchal society, and also white people with disabilities who had no support really from the apartheid government. But now, in terms of this act, they are excluded. I don't know if that is intentional or unintentional. I'm not sure what the rationale for that is, but they were included before, now they're being excluded, and so rights are taken away from them. And we need to know whether, as I said before, that is intentional or not. Secondly, if it is, what is the policy basis
for making that decision in taking rights away, and whether from a constitutional perspective the legal advisors have formed an opinion whether you can actually take those rights away. And if the right needs to be taken away, another question arises, Madam Speaker. I've done a little bit of research myself. I'm sorry. Madam Chair. Many of the organizations that represent people with disabilities are not aware of the changes taking place in this Act. And I think at the very least, as far as our obligations on public participation and engagement is concerned, we need to try and make contact with those organizations as well, so that they can make submissions. I know there were public hearings, but they did not really feature there, and I don't, and as I said, upon speaking to the executives of those organizations, they were not aware that these changes are taking place, and that's why I'm not sure whether they are intended or unintended, and it needs to be clarified. I think that covers everything that I wanted to say for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Elders. Can we then move to Honourable James?
Thank you very much, Chair. This amendment law deals with two things. It deals with funding, and it deals with the establishment of a council. That's principally what it does. But there's a third, very, very important thing, and that is to introduce, it's essentially force black empowerment to become genuinely broad-based. And that will be a consequence of implementing the right scorecard to drive in that direction. That's the purpose of the law. And it's done against the history of ethnic stripping against people who were largely black, African, in the past, and where there was both ethnic stripping and there was a denial of opportunities when it comes to business. So this bill must provide redress in the form of creating special opportunities for people in the area of business. That's what it's about. So land reforms into the land, employment equity with employment equity, all those things and so on. So the key thing, colleagues, is that we must be able to have a system whereby the problem to be resolved, which is the creation of special opportunities for people who were denied those opportunities under apartheid laws, as a manner of redress, so that could be entrenched in law, and that requires a definition of what is historically disadvantaged and not a definition of race. And that is what this proposal does, is define in law historical disadvantage. Does not define race. I think it's very dangerous for any government to try and define race. It happened under the apartheid government. It happened on a variety of other colonial governments as well. It happened in Germany under the Nazis and so on. I think it's a dangerous thing to fix race in law where you cannot fix race biologically. It's not a fixable entity. At the same time, what we have in terms of our media district is the use of a terminology that, as a matter of convenience, and that's black. And I mean, I don't really have a difficulty with that, even to recognize as a matter of convenience, and that it refers to something that can be precisely defined, which is what I've tried to do here. I'd like to add, I'd just like to say that I misspelled synonym, and that there's a missing bracket at the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Arnold James. I think the laws against the Jews in Germany at the time you mentioned were not only done legally, they were on the basis of biology as well, with the tests that were done. So, but there was an element of that as well, as there often is in these things. It was just a moot point, possibly you would consider that unnecessary or something. But now we've had Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Elder, Honourable James. We now have Honourable Kadebe, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, first of all, the person would like to appreciate the imposition made by Honourable James, that he went out of town to go and try to have something which he thinks might be able to solve the problem. But if there's one thing which is missing in his own argument, is one is that apartheid policy was based on rain. That was not change. There's no one who can rewrite that. Apartheid policy was based on race. So if you are going to affect anything to reverse apartheid policy, your starting point will always be race because it was based on race. So Chairperson, when you go to the National Credit Act, as supplied by the content advisor, you go down there. For all purposes of this act, a person is historically disadvantaged. If that person A is one of the category of natural persons who, before the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1993, came into operation were disadvantaged by unfair discrimination on the basis of race. That's the bottom line. What does this issue of race come into? Chair, we know very well that we had an act which established the National Population Register. That act was actually able to categorize the people. First of all, the white, the black, the colored, and the Indian. But with the consequence of that, definition, there was a lot of unfairness which came into this people categorized. I can make an example. They were not only disadvantaged. One, those who are categorized as black were also given inferior education. That's why today you are in the cycle of structural unemployment because of the years of bantu education which were given to a particular race. That's why when you go to take all the population groups which are in the country right now and just go to the register of engineers, the Engineering Council of South Africa, and see how many people are of black origin who are engineers compared to the population that are. Because that one disadvantage is like that, because that one was done through this issue of the population. That one disadvantage which came from it. The other disadvantage here will come to the issue of the ownership of property. One, we want to speak about the ownership of property, it means that we speak about the participation in the economy of the country. So you go again to the chief office. Go to the chief office. Anyone to go and do a search and see how many people who were categorized as black in the National Population Register are owning businesses in the industrial side of the country. Apart from the home, that's the industrial side. Various municipalities in the city there. That's local. How many of those people who are black own, have the access to those industrial sites? So you go again, Chair. You move apart from that. You move again to the so-called township. When you move to the township, Chairperson, you find a situation whereby the people in there, those who are categorized as black, if you were Sotho, you will stay in a Sotho section. It means that only people who are speaking Sotho will stay from one street to the other street in one block. Only people who are Sotho. If you are Zulu, you go and stay in a Zulu section. If you are Shangaan, where did the Shangaan stay? Shawelo. We'll stay in Shawelo. Exactly. So what is critical here, Chair, is that is advantage, né? That is advantage. It means that cross-cultural influence between the advanced ethnic groups within the black people was also emphasized. So what is happening here? Is that the National Population Register had huge implications for the livelihood of these people, apart from the fact that they were stripped of the land. They were categorized only 85% of the land of the country. That's why, even in those lands, they don't even have titles. Because those titles were given to the chiefs which were not even of origin, not the original chiefs. They imposed chiefs. So, this is a plethora of the huge disability. So those things can happen because we have this thing known as the National Population Register, which was based on race. So it means that even in this constitution, that's why I think I like about it. You speak about historical disadvantage. When you speak about historical disadvantage, the implication for that, man. As we said, this is what we said, Chairperson, is that when we were born on the 28th of April 1994, we are born in St. Paul. And then someone is born in St. Paul on the 28th of April 1994. And then someone else on the same day, 1994, is born on the Donkey Zizwe. Donkey Zizwe at Quarter Camp. Those two people will never be the same. The only thing to be common among these people is that one, you find that in the central area, the people who be there will be what the population register categorized as white. And then when you go to Donkey Zizwe Quarter Camp, very close by, you find that those people will be what we categorize as black. Those people will categorize as black. But what goes to the difference? That one on the Donkey Zizwe Quarter Camp, one will not have a clinic, will not have a school which is having a library, will not have a school which is having a library, will not have a school which is having a laboratory. That's the reality. So you go to that one. Who's in Stanford? That's why in Stanford. The likelihood is that one, the library where he or she is will be well equipped, will be well equipped. The laboratory will be well equipped. So it means that that medical number of 27 April 1994 did it will bring equality in terms of economic participation. That's why now when you go to the Act, the Broad-Based Black Community Empowerment Act, which we are amending. So here in this field, we are only amending G, F, G, and H. That's what we are amending. When you look at the objectives of the field, of the major acts which we are amending, it's very clear. Objectives of the field 2, the objective of this act are to facilitate broad-based economic empowerment and promoting economic transformation in order to enable meaningful participation of black people in the economy. That's the act which we are amending. That's why it's not being amended. Still the main interact. Member B, achieving substantial change in the racial composition of ownership, management structures, and the skills operating of existing and new enterprises. That one is not being changed. Because in under apartheid, Chair, if I had my way, in 1985, when I was supposed to have, after completing my trade, I wanted to become an engineer. I was to become an engineer in fact. Not that I didn't have a capacity. That's the wrong pigmentation. It's a fact. You could not get that because that's the wrong pigmentation. So, the issue of black here, black people cannot be used as a convenience because it's historic. Check. Thank you.
I'm just taking one other person from the ANC, Honorable Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. I think my colleague has covered most of what I want to say, but he said a lot. And I just want to emphasize the point that I wanted to make. And the first one was that I agree that it is an interesting discussion and there is merit in having such a discussion. But what we are trying to do is to right the wrongs of apartheid through this measure, through this bill and other measures. And apartheid, as my colleague discriminated against people based on race. But that's the first point. The point that Professor James makes, my honourable colleague, is about the franchise. And the franchise was merely one element of a plethora of discriminatory practices against the people of this country based on race. And as he mentioned, it's a question of business, which was also a discriminatory practice against people of colour. So I think that we ought to stick with the proposal that the subcommittee has come up with,
I think the point is it does say under apartheid law, which is very specific to a particular time period. But I think, you know, members, we explored this longer than we anticipated over three different sessions now. But I think that's right and proper. This is a very, very important piece of legislation. And yet, it is controversial in some quarters, indeed. And possibly particularly because of this. It is not my purpose as chair to enter in on this note here. My purpose was to ensure that all the parties who are present here had this opportunity to try to persuade each other what the issue is. That's my purpose as chair. And having done so, as a proponent of this, Honourable James, I will allow you just a short space to comment.
Chair, I just want to point out the implications of the subcommittee's proposal, which in fact I have I asked myself a question. If there was a dispute, how do you resolve a dispute for that definition? Would we then have to use a pencil test to check on the texture of people's hair? That is by keeping apart their definitions in there. You could only resolve it by having to have some test for it. And I just put that out there. That's why I propose this. Because you don't resolve it on the basis of, and I agree with Arnold van der Merwe. There's lots of building regulations, municipal and elsewhere, involved in the definition of business opportunities, not just the franchise. But this is a definition. And what I wanted to propose is a way that is robust, will not, can stand in a court of law, and where all we want to do is define who is black on the basis of objective criteria to do with those instruments that can make it possible for us not to resort to a party test for it. Thank you.
I must say, I didn't quite get that myself. When I looked at your clause, which as you, I've forgotten that you crafted it here, but it says here, under, persons classified under apartheid laws. There aren't any apartheid laws that I'm aware of, but I could, you know, I'm not a lawyer. Do we have an apartheid law here in operation at the moment, state law advisor?
As far as I know, well, they are still laws from the previous regime, but I think the intention here is clear. Apartheid laws means discriminatory laws, and our challenge was to find a word which fits here, and I think it's fairly clear what apartheid laws would constitute.
So, without opening the floor, without opening it, all I'm saying is the definition here, as it were, classified as under apartheid laws, I think to a large extent would exclude the pencil test because it's under apartheid laws and not under the new democracy laws. We don't have a pencil test in the new, you know, I only say that because it is in a reference to yourself. But what I think is the best now, there's a debate coming. Now, I can see strong positions coming out, in fact, stronger, and I must be frank. I've seen the way this is going. And the positions here, I can't see them merging. I think the best you can do is with the crafted one here. And it's on that basis, and of course we aren't the trumping one, but it's on this particular one, that I urge members to take into account the considerations of all members here when we take it forward and we say, do we have somebody to propose adoption of two? Do we have a seconder? Do we have an objection? You know, on that basis. So, first thing is we have somebody who proposes. Before we, are you going to propose an acceptance? No, I didn't think so. Yeah.
Can we please have, if we get someone, so we have someone to propose adoption. Honourable Debbie?
Sir President, I'm seconding. I am seconding what Honourable Super Member proposed, that we adopt the version of the subcommittee. The version of the subcommittee proposed, and that's what I'm supporting on that one. Because it's very clear, that's why it was accepted in the subcommittee, because it moved away from apartheid police to apartheid law in particular. So now it's very clear. So that whatever reference could be referred in terms of apartheid law.
So you, because we didn't even have this proposal, so to say, so we've got to start in a technical manner. Do you propose that we adopt the amendment put forward by the subcommittee, which is now in our committee, the full committee? Do you propose adoption?
Chairperson, I propose the proposal of the amendment of the subcommittee.
Do we have a seconder? Right. Honourable Kwabasa, are there objections? You may give your reasons. In very short form, let's not
Madam Chair, I would like to ask that we do not adopt yet. I think we should have another time to discuss it. And I listened very carefully to what Honourable Khadebe had to say. And and I'm not saying that I disagree with him, but I actually agree with his thinking, but I think his conclusion that Honourable James's proposal and amendment will deny this bill achieving the objectives that he wants to achieve is valid. I believe that this bill will achieve what he wants to achieve in terms of his understanding of his deprivation and the South Africans, most of South Africans' deprivation, with this amendment. So, what I'm, I think we should think about it, and maybe the ANC caucus needs to go and talk to other people about it. Because my assessment of what Honourable James has said is that the amendment will achieve exactly what Honourable Khadebe motivated in his address, and also I believe it will avoid us as a committee possibly entering into all sorts of further controversy.
Right. We have your on the one hand an objection, and on the other hand request, as it were, for extension. But the one you are supporting, and you're objecting to what is the subcommittee clause, which is here in front, which was proposed and adopted per se, and you are supporting the amendment made this morning by the Honourable James, just so that that's quite clear. Honourable Advocate Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on a technical basis, I've done a little bit of research on the Population Registration Act, which implicitly is alluded to in this bill and in this act as well. The change talks about persons specified as African, Arab, Indian, Chinese, and apartheid laws. The word African doesn't exist in apartheid laws. So, how can you put a word in there that is not consistent with what apartheid laws actually refers to? It does create ambiguity. So that's from a legal, technical point of view, I'm just making that point.
I see.
What
is African?
Yes,
yeah,
so we need to
specify under apartheid.
We need to investigate that, because it creates ambiguity as to what African would mean if you look at apartheid laws, which is technical. And then, and again,
let's have one
on the floor. Yeah, I'm not saying we should use the word, I'm not saying we should use derogatory words, but I'm just saying that we need to see how we refer to people, because if you look at Honourable James's submission, his submission is very
neutral. It doesn't allow for the use of historical words that might be derogatory or incorrect words, like African, which is an incorrect term. Otherwise, we must define African again. Right, but that's technical. Just on my issues that I submitted regarding people that are now being excluded or groups of people being excluded by this act, I just want to make a further note, and because I have not had an answer from the department on this, but I need to make a further note. The implications of exclusion in this act will force employers not to employ white women and white people with disabilities because they will not get points for it. So while the Employment Equity Act allows for employment in those categories of persons, they will not be employed in the future because of the effect of this bill. And I once again need to ask the DTI whether that is an intended consequence, and if so, on what policy basis are you taking rights that existed away, directly or indirectly? And if that is not the case, it's not supposed to be the case, then we need to make certain amendments in this bill as well. Thank you very much.
I know what you're saying, thank you. And after Honourable James has spoken, the DTI will comment. Honourable James.
Thank you, Chair. I haven't heard a single argument that makes a case for how my recommended changes would stop the achievement of the goal of the world, which is growth-based black economic empowerment. I haven't heard a single one. So let me just say that firstly. And if there is such an argument, I even would like to hear it. But what this does, it prevents us from going down the road of fixing race in law. That's what it does. Because once you entrench race in law, then you set a precedent that is very difficult to abandon. And I again want to ask the question, if there is a dispute around this, and somebody comes along and says, I am eligible because I'm black, or because I'm colored, or because I'm Indian, or because I'm Chinese, somebody has to prove that fact. Somebody has to prove it. And so that's why I use the pencil test. The resolution of a race-based dispute would have to be resolved by using measures to ascertain that race. Now the fact is that apartheid laws were part of these things, but I'm talking about current disputes. Current disputes. And I haven't heard a good answer to that question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dave. Now, we were at a point where we had a proposal and adoption, all right? We then asked for objections. There was only one technicality which made it require the state law advisor to look at. And in matters of process and procedure, I must take that up in the meeting before I go further. That is the issue persons classified as African. It's the issue of African that was raised on technicality. And I'm referring now, is it to Advocate Swart?
Says that this bill must be interpreted to fix effective objectives to
comply with the statute, comply with the constitution. In other words, the bill must be read purposely, as my colleague said, and I think it would be very clear for any court of law what it means by African, etc.
Now that is the opinion of the state law advisor and our own parliamentary advisor, which I have now got. So now the only other thing, because we've reached a point in the procedure where we've proposed, adopted, and the objections are being raised. There's only one other objection, other than the technical one which I've dealt with. The proposal, is it the proposal or a request? Should we, can we please have more time from Advocate Ellis? I'll give that to the whip to respond to.
Chairperson, what was we mean is that when we come back to this local committee, we expect a bill which will be having some sort of a green. Chairperson, we expect a bill which will come with some sort of green letter, which indicates what we agreed upon. But the original deal will be as it is, and then in brackets, the green things which we have agreed upon. So I think that the green colors, because we have to move forward. Yeah. So with that green, this black and green thing to be there, we'll still open the time for debate again. Because this is not a final adoption at all. Yeah. So I think that it's opening the way for that. But in the meantime, Chair, the proposal last is that amendment of the subcommittee to be taken must put there.
We also have a process which does call for another amendment to be considered. If you don't have another amendment at this point, as you sit there, Honourable Ellis, as you sit there, you may want to fine-tune it. You have that opportunity after it comes back from CREDA. We haven't, we haven't adopted the whole bill yet. We've gone clause by clause. We've taken the point. This particular one is objected to by Cope, by Freedom Front, and by the DA. And you will have the opportunity before it gets to the House of putting an amendment to us, the creature. I hope I'm quite clear here. We're trying to follow our procedure directly on this matter. The objections have been made. We bring this bill back after the CREDA version. CREDA means everything is incorporated with the exception of these other amendments or fine changes that have crept, typos or whatever. Now I'll just check with my own committee secretary, because I understand that.
Chairperson, the committee in principle agrees on the most of causes, and what will happen is we will send it to CREDA, we will bring the draft to the committee where all the causes will be moved and where parties will have opportunity to come to propose amendments to the bill, and the committee will then vote on that bill. After that process, we will finalise the bill as it needs to by the committee. So the parties will have
the second thing is to do with the department, the something clause. You raise the issue of, in that clause, just the length of its implementation or effective operation. Am I correct? It's not here, we need it for CREDA. So please read that into your clause now, if you want to take it to CREDA. You've got it here. Who is this? The state law advisor. The SMUX, Advocate SMUX.
Mr. Chairperson, I just want to explain is that the aim of the clause in its earnest is in relation to the trumping clause as well as proposed section 10, or only in relation to the trumping clause.
It deals with both the trumping clause. It has got here. I mean, the section 10 you referred to, the trumping clause should be read together with section 10. So that could apply to that. So that applies to both what you put here as the trumping clause
and the reference to section 10. And so just phrase it for our benefit now, please.
I would suppose I haven't reflected on this properly, but I think that Chairperson had it correct. At the end of the act, bill, we repeated all this act for so and so, a country of operation in state, fixed by president, who have subclauses which says section so and so takes effect a year after the commencement of this act. So those two sections will only be put into effect a year after.
A year after the act has been assented to.
Commencement. After the
commencement of the act.
Yes.
Right. There's the proposal on that one. So, on that trumping clause then, we have someone to propose adoption. Yes, Honourable Kobasa, seconded by Honourable Jay. Right. Now, members, it has been a grueling experience, and I would hope that the committee secretary can identify here the time when we're meeting specifically to take this forward up. Peter, I think it is Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. And that the program is as is.
The next scheduled meeting to deal with the our E bill is scheduled for next week, Thursday, at 2 o'clock, to allow us time to do the cleaner process.
And that is Thursday at 3:05. I hope that Thursday at 3:05, E:305. Oh, you may have to confirm the venue at 2. The only thing is, I did see people smiling. I don't know if the program, they are aware of certain program changes I'm not aware of, but this is the program as it stands. I don't know, Honourable James, you're aware that we can do that thing. I've never seen anything on that day.
I understand. I'm not in the country then, but that's not your problem.
But you will have the Honourable Hill Lewis at the time. All right. Okay, now that's all that then is required. So I'll ask the Secretary to hand out the revised program. You will recall that the program was revised only because we had changes in some of the debates which came out yesterday, I believe. Yes, Advocate?
We respond now in relation to the delaying of the trumping. We didn't mention the issue that we later when we set up the one as far as it be possible.
And we've agreed to that indeed. We agreed to that. It was just the delay issue we had.
Yes, Chairperson, but there was also a submission that says that if you take that out, then you have to make allowance for exemptions, which is what we discussed during the break. So I have a clause in there where there is an exemption for the emergency.
All right, well then, let's just take that up now. Just give it to us, your formulation. Who's going to give it to us?
It was done on short notice and not.
Yeah, Advocate Smart.
Thank you, not discussed for this part, but it may be something like. The minister may, after consultation with the relevant organ of state or public entity, exempt the organ of state or public entity from the requirements contained in subsection 1 or allow a deviation therefrom if particular facts or circumstances applicable to the organ of state or public entity taken objectively necessitates an exemption or deviation.
And that is coming in on page 5. Is that correct? The 10. Let's just leave it because we now knew that, you know, we must just do things correctly here. Yes, the Chief Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would go on here with the technical advisor on the proposal because we did inform them that that procedure is set out in the code and in the guidelines.
So there is a provision, however, it was not in the primary legislation, but in the courts themselves. So the issue of now elevating it to the principal and then more support to ensure that the clarity and the issues that have been highlighted are properly addressed. However, on the second issue that we want clarity on, that when we talk about the delay of coming into effect of Section 10, we just wanted to confirm with the statement about that it must not have the effect of them saying people will not apply the code, because that Section 10 refers to all those activities, licensing, procurement, disposal, all the economic activities. So if we say we delay a year from now, it must not have the implication then that nothing happens until the year comes into effect. So we just wanted to confirm on that.
So you want the trumping to be delayed?
If possible, yes,
yeah, well, that's what we agreed to. We didn't agree to all the codes being delayed, but the trumping to be delayed per se. And that we want very clear, which we all agreed to. All right? Now, we'll get this out in CEDA, and that'll have to be tightened up with the legal people and the committee secretary today, so that it goes to CEDA by 3 o'clock, I think. It is Friday. So that they've got it this afternoon, and then it takes them that time, and we'll have it back in Parliament on Wednesday afternoon. Please make that available to all parties. And can those who want amendments come in here, can they please have them writing exactly as you did it, Honourable James, before the committee, and the same for yourself, Honourable Albert. Are we all agreed on that point? Well, members, look, by and large, there has been broad agreement on things. It has left the one issue out where there has not been agreement. And I think most members of the committee would like to implement the intention of the Act, but they're not in agreement as to how that intention should be addressed in the Act. Is that not the point? It's not the agreement on the actual language to review and the designation. That is what it's all about. Honourable James?
Yeah, there is agreement on the intention.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
There's a difference on a nomenclature that has been used to define the demand.
So the difference is only on the nomenclature and the actual terms used in the bill, and it's the one issue. I say that because I know that there are some members of the media, so that we're quite clear as to what is agreed and what is not agreed, and where we will be taking amendments. Honourable Elders?
Frankly, one outstanding matter, as I said before, is that there must be clarification from the department regarding who is regarded as people who will benefit from this Act. Whether disabled white women and white disabled are excluded or not, and what the reasons are. Thank you.
In other words, does it exclude the disabled?
Thank you, Chair. I think we'll refer back to the initial stages when we first started this process, where we had clarifying this position and the department, that if you look at the intention of the bill and its preamble, it talks about broadening participation and effective participation by black people into the mainstream of the economy. The beneficiaries are clearly defined, and as far as we remember from the onset of the bill started in the BEA in 2003, white women and people with disabilities or white have never been passed, never been designated as beneficial of this legislation. Yes, they are accounted for in other parts of the legislation, but not within the PE legislation. So we have clarified that solution. As far as I said, that they were there, we have discussed, they have never been part of the designated group under this particular legislation.
Right.
And also, Chair, sorry, we also want to indicate, therefore, that the submission that is posted in the promulgation of this amendment act, white people or white women or white people with disabilities will not get employment or opportunities, is actually not true, because since the promulgation of the Code of Practice in 2007, it's all hard that is how the abolition of the Act has been. So we have not tampered with the issue of the beneficiaries and the targeted form.
Thank you very much. Now, we're not entertaining any further comments. We are getting the bill back. I hope everyone is clear on that. I really want to close off now, Honourable Debbie, because then somebody else is going to comment.
I think the matter of omission which we did late, like, when it comes to the appointment of the commissioner and the deputy commissioner, this thing really provides for a section where both the commissioner and deputy commissioner are incapacitated to do their job. What happens? We empower the minister to appoint someone in the interim until the other appointment. So I want that this guy on the other side, they must come with that provision. Because we cannot have a law whereby it does not provide for the incapacity of the people who are in charge. I think that that's a serious commission was made.
I mean, you can't turn it off like that, because the thing is, it's going to freeze us. We have to take it on now. We can't leave it. I don't think anyone, is there any member of the committee who disagrees with the provision? Any member? No. So, please draft it exactly on the basis that should the commissioner or deputy and deputy commissioner be incapacitated at the same time. In this bill, we want a provision made that would enable the minister to appoint. Are we quite clear on that? It's just a thing.